Welcome to Backyard Oasis, a podcast designed by and for older adults living in the beautiful Pioneer Valley of Western Massachusetts and produced in the tech studios at Greenfield Community College in Greenfield, Massachusetts. Backyard Oasis reaches out to older adults who seek knowledge to help them live more thoughtfully, healthily, and happily, who hope to inspire others with their ideas, and who serve their communities in the interest of the greater good.
Hi, I'm Denise Schwartz, your host. I'm speaking again with Dan Conlon of Warm Colors Apiary in South Deerfield, Massachusetts, in this, a second episode in a series about our shared commonwealth. And that's the land, the water, the air, well, everything we use on this planet to sustain our lives and the lives of other living things. But first, a little more about Dan. He's a professional beekeeper who works with the USDA Agricultural Research Service's Genetics Lab to identify inheritable genes that improve honeybees' defenses against varroa mites and disease. Dan was president of the Massachusetts Beekeepers Association, and he was Massachusetts Beekeeper of the Year a few years back. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Denise.
So today we're going to talk about insects again, or like bugs, and our environment. And that sounds sort of like, you know, kind of dry, but no. We have two themes today, and we're going to try to stay with them, Dan. We're going to talk about public space and the commonwealth of our environment, our commonwealth. And then we're going to talk about our planet has a limit. Stop wasting its resources. Mm-hmm. And when we do that, we're going to talk about how we should all really do our parts to stop wasting food and reuse what the planet cannot replenish. And this is really your place, Dan. I want you to just start.
Okay. I guess the first thing is, you know, I think of the environment as everybody's space. And what I mean by that, it's, you know, it's all shared space. We all are a part of the same world. So that sort of brings us to, you know, understanding a couple of things about the United States, for example. You know, we don't have the environment that our ancestors had. At this point in time, we've probably changed all the plants. We've changed the rivers. We've redefined land use, and the so-called natural world, which in my mind is when you let things just grow the way they're going to grow, may be represented in the original form at about 5%, and that's our national parks. Other than that, very little in this country is what it was in the 1600s when the Europeans first arrived. So keep that in mind. And the only reason I bring that up is that I think part of the environmental concerns and movement have to recognize that we aren't going to go back. We aren't going to turn it back into what it was.
But we can do some things relative to how things could go back a little bit.
Yeah.
Like I'm thinking about, and I want you to keep going on, but immediately I started thinking about indigenous peoples and how they lived on the environment and how they're becoming more and more top of mind when people talk about nature and how we're going to live. And so maybe we can go back and learn some things from how indigenous peoples lived on this really beautiful earth and do some things to sustain it the way they kind of did.
And that's the key word, sustaining it. You know, we need to find ways as a modern society to basically replenish what we use and not let ourselves just drain. And that's the piece of the space that we need to pay attention to. You know, so much of what we live in today, and I've said this before, I think I probably said it in our first segment, which is, you know, some 30% of all the plants in Massachusetts are introduced species that came in after the Europeans got here.
Right.
So that's pretty common stuff, too. A lot of these plants are everyday plants. Locust trees, for example. Those were put here by us. I mean, you know, by the USDA, to be exact.
Well, why is that bad?
Well, they're considered invasive. They are a change in species. I don't think the locust trees are particularly bad because they're a nice honey plant, but I'm a beekeeper, so I see some of these invasives a little different than the other person, which, of course, is the other sort of distracting part of this is what I perceive as really a wonderful plant may be something you say, oh, I'm so sick of these things, they just take over everything.
But that's such, you know, that's, should we let our personal likes and dislikes really guide what we as a species, humans, do in our world? Don't we have to get over this thing that everything should be what I like and do what is best for the greater good? Don't we need a cultural shift in most of these cases to think about where we're going here?
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think the cultural shift in my mind is for us human beings to start recognizing that all these shared plants and creatures around us are also very important to our survival.
To our survival.
And so we have to start looking beyond our own personal needs and say, we got to protect these other things that are making the world a better place to live.
Two things about that. Is that what you refer to as our common wealth? And is it our job to do that? Is it our job to make sure that all the other species are taken care of?
Well, you know, the commonwealth in my mind has always been a wonderful word for any kind of government or leadership kind of things, because what it implies is that there are certain things that everybody should have a right to.
Such as?
Clean air, clean water. Mm. And if you remember, early in our colonial days, we had the town common. Now, the town common used to be so everybody could graze their sheep or whatever.
Cows.
Take turns. Yeah, take turns grazing. And a lot of the resources were shared by the community. But it also meant that all of the community sharing took responsibility for maintaining that.
Oh, we don't really do that, do we?
No, we do not. We have turned that over to government to be responsible for the public places in a different way. That used to be a direct benefit to private individuals who had sheep or cows or whatever they were doing, right?
Sure.
But the other thing was, you know, you didn't pollute the water that your neighbor had to drink too, and you did not, you know, of course, back then they weren't so focused on the quality of the air, but, you know, they were burning wood and so forth, and who knows what if there were problems with it then. But, yeah, absolutely we needed to have clean air, clean water. And that shouldn't have been something that ever got privatized.
Well, so why did it?
Because, you know, it certainly changed, I think, over time because you started having people own bigger and bigger pieces of land. And then industry came along.
Industry.
Industry changed a lot, manufacturing and industry, because unfortunately along with those things came certain waste products that needed disposal.
Sure.
And
into
the rivers. That was easier. Mm-hmm. Let it flow down to the ocean. You know, the ocean's infinite, right?
That's how we were thinking of it, right?
Yeah, sure. So nobody really thought too much about that in those days. And also the population has expanded to the point where we put a huge demand on what we did when we had a billion people on the planet,
right,
or 2 billion.
Right.
You know, and so I think, you know, as the population in the world has grown, so are the need for sewage, for one. There's a huge, huge problem. It's a huge problem in this area because we're all small towns and it costs you $50 million to fix your sewage plant.
Yes.
And you got 5,000 people paying taxes. That's a hell of a burden.
That's a big burden.
So there's an awful lot of economics that come into it. And in some cases, I think that in the old days, when you had companies rationalizing, we get to do some things because we're giving people jobs and we're helping the economy. Okay, legitimate arguments,
yes.
Except it doesn't mean you can pollute everything either. You know?
So we say we're not going to be able to go back, but it sounds like we kind of have to in a way to get past some of these problems that we ourselves have created. And government, you said, was taking care of some of that.
Yeah, yeah.
But we also sort of look at government as being like the bad person, you know. They're allowing industry to do things. But you want to talk a little bit about some of the good things that happened under...
Yeah, and I'm not to interrupt, but it just... The whole issue of land use, you know, we need a better strategy for planning land use. You know, for example, there was a point when I was on the Board of Health in one of the towns, and one of the things that was always sort of I would realize was we were responsible for verifying septic systems were properly installed, right? And it was always in the very best ground because that was easy digging, good drainage, you know. And I realized in Vermont, they had a little different approach to that because they had less good agricultural areas.
Yeah.
So they allowed people to put septics in rocky places on the sides of hills and things, which weren't going to be used for other things. To me, that always made more sense. And
does the septic system work as well that in that kind
of
thing?
It can, because the engineers can design these things. You know, that was the other sort of thing. I shouldn't say this, but I was always aware that one size fit all in those days.
Yeah.
But you were paying for engineering drawings that were Xeroxed and handed over.
Okay, Dan, let's get back on track now. So, here he goes.
But the point... We're
talking about our commonwealth.
Yes, the commonwealth. And there has to be controls for those kind of things. But what I'm saying is the strategies for planning land use, I think, is really important. We do need places to live. We need places to conduct business. But we also need the farms for food. And I think we need open space to preserve the rest of our nature so we could actually design future towns with more open space within them.
People thinking about that, though?
In places they are. Places like India. I mean, there are architectural designs that they're actually employing that are changing the face of some of these overpopulated places. And, how successful that is with a population that's the biggest in the world. I don't know how that's going to play out. But the point is, they aren't sitting back and saying, we're not going to try. We're not going to try to do something better. And I think cities. Cities could be so much more pleasant if you had a little more green space, if you had more walking space, if you made it, like a lot of the European cities.
Right.
They are actually more pleasant because people sort of slow down and walk a lot and stay healthier for that reason.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. You know, I just came back from traveling, and I'm going to talk about it later when we talk about food waste. But we were traveling in Scandinavia, and people there hike and walk and ski, and they do everything. Not everybody, but many, many people. And I was really taken by the fact that whatever hotel we stayed in, whether it was in the city or out in a small town, right there on the concierge desk, there were trail maps.
Mm-hmm.
And if you asked, I have an hour, where can I go for a walk? Folks at that desk would be able to tell you exactly.
Mm-hmm.
They would hand you a trail map. I mean, it was something that people do. They want to be outside.
Yes.
And that happened in Stockholm. It happened in Oslo. There were loops around the city.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't find this in a lot of cities around here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's wonderful. I mean, I think that's, you see a lot of it in the valley here with the bike trails and things like that that they've established in recent years. And I do see those getting used, it seems like, more and more. So I think we're seeing some efforts to do more of that. But anyway, the public lands that we have, the parks and so forth, they have management by government laws and standards. So they're actually... maybe we need to have more of that into the public realm that really makes more sense. And understand, I believe that a lot of those standards are to protect preservation and kind of slow that disruption to the ecology in these places. And so our government's approach to parks and things has been to maintain it as is, not let it get too disrupted. And that's a worthy goal for those spaces. But think about this. The parks also become magnets for people to go when they want to relax,
right,
have a picnic, take a walk. It's like those are the places you want. So I think that's the kind of thing that I'm talking about with sort of redefining our spaces and taking advantage of the natural need we all seem to have.
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about, I know we had a conversation before and you were talking about how we tend to look at what government does now for us, but you were talking about some of the things that government did quite a long time ago, like in the 70s.
Oh, yeah. No, think about this. I mean, I know President Richard Nixon sort of went out with some baggage, and in history we kind of viewed him poorly. But what people forget is he created the EPA in 1970. And his first...
The Environmental Protection Agency.
Environmental Protection Agency, which is now under fire by some of the politicians. But his first director was William Ruckelshaus, and Ruckelshaus in the first 3 years, and as I list these five things, anybody listening is going to say, oh my God, that's only 1970? I thought it was always that's when we banned DDT. Oh. Ruckelshaus and his people banned DDT. Now, the second thing that happened is that was the first time we set air standard qualities for pollution to the air, right? That's when we went to lead-free gasoline.
Oh, I remember.
And required cleaner burning cars. That's when our first environmental law enforcement was developed, where these guys were actually serious enforcement people and went after polluters. And we had the Superfund started to clean up the waste pits that some of these unsavory manufacturers had left for the public to pay the bill on. And it was the first introduction where we required industry and cities to have clean water permits. They had to be inspected and have certain standards of what was released into the water, into the rivers and so forth. Those were the years of what we used to refer to as the straight pipes.
I don't know what that is.
Straight pipes is from the sewer pipe to the water. Nothing in between. So a lot of that chemical and human waste was being dumped right into water systems like the rivers. And my own personal feeling about that is when I first moved to this area, Connecticut River was really such a
I remember this.
Nothing
yes.
but dead fish, and you wouldn't put your foot in that water.
That's right.
Well, it's really changed tremendously today. So it's, you know, so I just say that because I think the EPA is one of those agencies that gets a lot of criticism. But on the other hand, I feel like that might have historically been the most significant moment in this country for environmental reform that we ever have seen to this day.
I think we've just forgotten.
We've forgotten. But having that agency and empowered to really go after violators, I think, is a necessity, even if they sometimes get it wrong.
Now, see, you're in the business so that you would really understand this and keep track of it. Is the EPA still doing that? And why is it becoming under fire?
Well, because they're going after sometimes businesses and farms and ranches that are in violation, and of course that starts being this issue of you're imposing your government will on me, and so
I'm not going to vote for you again.
Well, that's part of it too. There's a lot of lobbyists. You know, I remember talking to one of our representatives at a meeting, and he was saying, when he's been on the agricultural committee, and we talked about this subject, and he was saying, you would not believe the number of lobbyists that we deal with who are trying to get after agencies like that are enforcement agencies, because they have their clients who pay them to come to Washington and try to sway Congress people and so forth. So there's a lot of pressure. A lot of pressure. Well, to remove the regulations.
So that they can profit more and not have to be subject to regulations.
That's right. That's right.
But see, that's just the opposite of doing something for the greater good.
What's that?
Wanting to have regulations removed or not wanting to be able to follow regulations and have somebody lobby against them.
Yeah.
Because what the regulations are there for are to protect the greater good, to protect all of us.
And as citizens, I guess my point of all of this is, sometimes we should be really standing up for these groups and agencies. These are our people protecting our health and our safety. And we should be in favor of that, you know.
Well, before we go on to something a little bit lighter, which is the food waste thing and not wasting resources, why do you think we've forgotten that some of these agencies are doing things that are good for us? Why isn't that what's out there? Oh, I mean, we're reminding people right now, and now I'm really glad we are.
Yeah.
Why isn't that out there? Why don't people know?
Short
memory, I guess.
I don't know. I wonder if they teach civics in high school anymore. I don't know that.
No, they don't.
Because I'm always astounded at how little some people know about how our government should operate.
Yeah.
So you start there. If we grew up in a time when that was part of what you took history courses, current events, or whatever you called it. And I found those things to be really interesting. And I also, that is where I sort of formed my feelings about what the American democracy should be and look like. And to me, part of that is to be a voter who is tries to be informed. Now, I don't know everything, obviously, but I do try to look at issues from both sides and make a decision. And frankly, I've always said this, I want to vote for people who do that. I don't expect to agree with them all the time, but I do expect them to be looking after our overall interests, everybody's.
Absolutely, not that's just who, saying that they are.
Yeah, and the special interests, I think, have maybe gotten a little too far.
Well,
but that's, you know, again, that's a political statement, not based on anything I can qualify.
Well, I think, you know, is because of what you do for a living, you know, you're working with bees and you're every day in touch with the natural environment. You're a person who would learn more about this and know it. But maybe a lot of people who are doing work like you do are not able to articulate what you just have and not talk about some of the things that agencies have been able to do for us that are positive. So maybe we need more of that.
Well, that's why I list these things from the EPA.
Yeah.
You know, you look back and you say, well, most of us have forgotten those were even issues because it's always been with us.
It's been with us since
the 70s. That's the law.
And it's not news.
It's not news.
It's not news.
That's
so
right.
We don't keep bringing it up.
Or we forget that the Superfund funds to clean up all of these waste dumps that has been going on for
since the 70s
have really improved the environment in many ways. Those have made a significant difference. So government can drive reform in a good way too. And you know, it's not that I'm necessarily a huge fan of the EPA. I just see them as a necessary agency that's very good to have.
Okay.
Because who else is going to do it? If you don't have a specific group of people in government assigned the job of doing it, it just sort of gets shifted around to what's the popular debate today.
Yeah,
and everything else gets forgotten for a while. But you got to have people doing this every day for their careers.
Well, for their careers, or you can have grassroots organizations doing that, which leads
which
us
they
into
are.
Something
which they are. Yeah.
That we also want to talk about, because we have kind of taken up half of our time already on this really important stuff.
So,
there are grassroots organizations that are going to do some things in terms of wasting resources.
Right.
And that's what we want to talk about now, food waste and being able to reuse what the planet can't replenish on its own. Even though I think with enough time going by, it probably can replenish almost anything except maybe minerals and stuff like that that we take out of the ground. So where are we going to start with talking about that?
Well, I would say we start with you know, as a culture, we've become very tolerant of wasteful practices. And I always start with packaging.
Oh, yes.
Packaging is ridiculous. If you've ordered anything from Amazon, what did I order one time? And I don't order a lot from Amazon, but I think I ordered some of the little memory cards for my camera. Two. They're little flat things in a piece of thing about this big. I got them in a box filled with bubble wrap. And it's like there was so much, there was more money in the packaging, I think, than there was in the things I ordered. And I was like, then I got to throw this away because I don't need it. And it's kind of like, well, it's just amazing to me. Every time we buy something, it's like, well, you got to get through all this packaging to get to this item. You know?
Well, so what are we supposed to do? I mean, packaging is out there.
We didn't always do that.
No.
When we were kids, that's not the way they sold things.
That's right.
You know, I mean, to the good, it's, you know, Benita and I always take our reusable bags to the grocery and stuff, and that's a great thing. They've started looking, at least around here, no plastic bags in the groceries. Mm-hmm. It's going to be paper, something that will break down with time.
Compostable bags are out there. But, you know, there's another thing. Yep. I know I went into Atlas Farm the other day. I only got a bunch of carrots. And they nicely asked if I needed a bag. And I thought, no, I don't need a bag. And I didn't need to bring my recyclable bag in or my everyday bag.
Yep.
I could walk out a bunch of carrots. So I tried something. I went to a discount department store. Well, I went to TJ Maxx. Come on. And I bought a shirt. Uh-huh. Well, it was actually a really pretty little blouse.
Uh-huh.
And I tried the same thing with the cashier. Would you, you know, I'll get you. I said, oh, I don't need a bag. I'm just going to walk out with it like this. And she kind of looked at me like, oh, that's great. And I thought, oh, I wonder if I'm going to get stopped, you know, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And I walked out holding my one item that really didn't need to be put in a bag.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, good for me. But that's kind of where we're going. What kinds of things can we do?
That's a good thing right there.
And we can talk about...
Be conscious of what you're
conscious.
Doing. Start with being conscious. You know, because I think this is a culturally learned problem that starts very young. Now, if you grew up in a household like I did, where my parents, when they were getting started, were pretty poor.
Oh. Oh.
And they had four kids.
Oh.
Well, no, they were fine. We had a good life. No, we never knew we were poor.
Yeah.
But the point was, you know, mom and dad were pretty good about, you know, don't waste anything.
Don't waste it.
And if you took food, you ate it.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because I have some fun facts about food waste. Would you like to hear some?
I would.
Okay.
I would.
And let me just tell you, I'm only going to read, maybe five of them. And there are about 1,000 that you could find that were, I want to find the source right here. The Food and Agricultural Organization of the United Nations, European Commission, EU Fusions, United States Department of Agriculture, United States Environmental Protection Agency, which we just talked about a lot, World Resources Institute, and the Danish Environmental Protection Agency. And these are some of the facts that I thought people might want to hear. And this is all about food waste, which, you know, we all do. There are over 7 billion people on this planet, of which 925 million are starving. Yet we annually lose and waste 1.3 billion tons of food. That's enough to feed 3 billion people. That's not a fun fact. I want to take that title back. That's not a fun fact.
Distribution.
Food loss and waste accounts for about 4.4 gigatons of greenhouse gas emissions per year. To put this in perspective, if food loss and waste were its own country, it would be the world's third largest greenhouse gas emitter, surpassed only by China and the United States.
Wow.
Next, fruits and vegetables, plus roots and tubers, have the highest wastage rates of any food. The food currently wasted in Europe could feed 200 million people. If just 1/4 of the food currently lost or wasted globally could be saved, it would be enough to feed 870 million hungry people. Wait, more. At retail level, that's in our stores, large quantities of food are wasted due to quality standards that overemphasize appearance. No, we're going to have to throw that apple away because it doesn't look good. Nobody's going to buy it. Or that banana.
That's right.
This is something that I know that we are all talking about here because we have so many small farms here. And a lot of small farms, you know, they now offer their bags of utility apples or utility peaches. Ones that are a little bit bruised but still delicious and wonderful. Mm-hmm. And that's a really good thing. So this fact to me really, it really spoke to me.
It also speaks to the need for growers to use more pesticides to keep those things looking perfect.
Exactly. And that's why we're talking about this in terms of environmental impact. Mm-hmm. If we could accept the fact, and I know it's really hard because when I see a fruit or a vegetable, I'm a vegetarian, I eat tons of vegetables. When I see one that just doesn't look right, I wonder, should I eat it? Is there something wrong with it? Mm-hmm. Can I serve it to folks who are coming over for dinner? In fact, you know, you're coming over for dinner on Sunday, and I think I'm going to give you some apples that don't look so good and see if you eat them.
It's the only kind we get.
Wait a minute. I have more.
Okay,
hold on.
Go on.
Okay, so what can we do? What can we do? Here are one or two things, and then you and I are going to talk more about waste. Have the empty your fridge day. I love that. Use up all of your leftovers. Sunday is usually a good day to cook meals with leftovers. Once every month, have an empty your freezer day. Also, be sure to have your empty your fridge freezer days before the holidays like Christmas, Easter, Thanksgiving, Hanukkah, etc. to make new room for all the good leftovers. Empty your fridge day. Just don't keep filling it up. Why? Because keep in mind, a really full refrigerator wastes energy. It takes more energy to keep everything fresh, okay? Your refrigerator is not your garbage bin. Make sure that no old leftovers are left to die in the back of your fridge. Remember not to overstuff your fridge. If you overstuff your fridge, it will be more difficult for the cold air to circulate, thus keeping food fresh. Keep good hygiene and regularly clean your fridge and your freezer. I bet a lot of us don't do that. Wait, only a few more. Stop producing UFOs. Yes, unidentified frozen objects in your freezer. UFOs are all good leftovers that you freeze and then forget about. After a year or two, you usually throw them out. You're wasting food. Your time, your money, good food, and your electricity bills are all for nothing when you do this. Prevent UFOs by freezing the leftovers in smaller portions and always have a system to note what you have frozen and when. My mother did that. Tape on everything she froze with a name, what it is, and when she froze it. I don't do that. And remember to use the food in your freezer so your freezer won't become the last stop before the garbage bin. One more thing. Learn to store food properly. apples, pears, bananas, and oranges should not be in contact with each other. Otherwise, they will ripen faster. Sometimes you want that to happen. Tomatoes, avocados, potatoes, and bananas and citrus fruits must be stored outside the refrigerator. Citrus fruits? I thought they had to go in the refrigerator. I was so glad that I read this. Use packaging only suitable for food when you package up your stuff. Don't use that bag that you put your shoes when you got them back from the shoe repair shop to put your leftovers in. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I thought all of those things were really important if we're going to talk about using resources.
They are good things. You know, I think, you know, it does start, you know, with not taking more than you need.
Don't take more than you need.
You know, and you know, it's been easier as I've gotten older and Benita's gotten older. We used to always produce more food than
yes.
we really needed. So those darn leftovers got to be the problem of, do we have to eat that again tonight?
Exactly.
And then we said, well, why are we making so much to begin with? We don't eat it for 3 days.
You know,
and that just changed once you kind of realize, we don't need that.
We don't need it.
It's not like we're going hungry. I know I'm not.
And the other thing is, don't buy more than you need. You know, I remember with Mom, we used to buy so much and we would store it. But now there are two of us in the house. We don't need to buy so much. Yes, maybe we will have. I mean, this is like how do you really balance things? Maybe I'll only buy enough for today's and tomorrow's dinner, but then I have to get in my car and drive to a store and buy more. So is that offsetting what I'm doing by not wasting food? I don't know.
Yeah. No, I think you're talking about something that, I always appreciated that the times we've gone to Europe that people tend to buy a day or two ahead, and they go out to the market and get their bread and whatever they're going to have. And I thought that was a nice way to live.
Wait, so you brought up Europe. And once again, you know, I have this thing that I thought it really opened my mind. So there we were in Norway and we were on a group tour and we were staying at this beautiful hotel with a beautiful dining room and we were having our group dinner there that night. I'm vegetarian. I don't eat any animals. And there were a few other people in the group that also opted for a vegetarian dinner. And we had to let the hotel know in the morning who was going to have fish, who was going to have meat, and who was going to have a vegetarian dinner. So we sit down that night, and everybody's being served their entrees. Everybody's laughing and having a good time. And a few other people besides me who wanted a vegetarian meal were served this beautiful meal. And suddenly I realize, I don't have anything in front of me. Yoo-hoo, tour guide, what's going on? And he comes over, he goes, oh, I don't know. I'm going to go back and talk to the kitchen manager. So we did. And then the kitchen manager comes out and goes, oh, I am so sorry. I'm so sorry to say this, but there was a little problem. I'm like, what's that? I'm so used to like never having food when I go places because I don't eat animals. And I was ready to hear this sad story, and it blew my mind what this person said. Well, one of our servers inadvertently served the vegetarian options to another group, and I'm sorry. We don't have anything else to serve you. And I was like, what? You don't have any more of the quinoa in your kitchen? You don't have any more carrots? And do you know what I found out? They get the orders for dinner for that night. They have food to prepare those dinners, and they don't buy in excess. And so, honestly, they were not able to put together another meal for me. Mm-hmm. I thought it was an excuse until they told me that, no, there are a lot of countries now where restaurants are doing that. They have signed on to not waste food.
Yes.
And I found it out in a kind of hard way, but I was thrilled to know that they were doing that.
That's great. That speaks volumes to what we would have to do in this country to really get a handle on all that.
Well, Denmark is doing that. I'm trying to find some information I had. Oh, it's on my phone. There's a Stop Wasting Food movement in Denmark. It's their largest nonprofit movement against food waste. It was founded in 2008, and it's gained the support of over 60,000 people, a number of leading top politicians, and acknowledged food personalities in Denmark. And they're getting a lot of publicity about that. They have a goal, and the goal is, let's see, it actively works with the implementation of the United Nations Sustainable Development Goal 12.3, which is by 2030 to cut in half per capita global food waste at the retail and consumer levels and reduce food losses among production and supply chains, including post-harvest losses. I thought that was wonderful. That's what that country is doing. Yeah.
That's great. Now, your list of things to avoid with wasting food, One of the things I was thought about was, you know, a lot of what you were referring to as far as people who are not getting that food, it's distribution. And distribution, by the way, has become this world distribution to bring food into this country and other places all over the place at a huge cost in energy and just adding to the cost of this food. And so one of the things is, you know, we have to sort of get ourselves back to a point where we're regionalizing our food sources. And maybe sometimes you just don't have to have everything all the time that's in the stores.
Dan, are we really going to make that big cultural shift?
Well, no, I think that cultural shift is eventually going to be forced on the next generation.
Because, I know.
Because I can tell you right now, one of the things, if you read the UN's, some of the UN's plans, one of the huge concerns, by the way, and you're talking about all these people who are starving,
millions,
and refugees.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the biggest reason we have refugees today is, of course, we have conflict, war.
Sure.
One of the reasons we're having all that conflict is really that we've reached a point where this human migration is, a lot of it is about hunger, health, and food insecurity, or insecurity in general. Now, that forces more conflict because now you see like the kind of debates you see in this country about immigration.
Exactly.
It's like it's all of a sudden it's a big deal and it's a problem. And we're the least country that should complain about that, by the way.
Yeah, but let's not go there, Dan.
I know, but I'm just saying part of this is because of the fact that we do have enough food.
We do have enough
food. The waste alone, as you point out,
could feed
all these people. But they can't get this where they are. I remember back when Clinton was president, remember Somalia?
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely.
With the warlords.
Right.
We sent the Somalians hundreds of tons of food. And the warlords confiscated it.
Right.
And they sort of made this they blackmailed everybody. You got to be loyal to us or you don't get any food.
Right.
The food was there. They just couldn't, the people couldn't have access to it. And so much of what we see today. But one of the things the UN says is, you know, the democratic cultures and Western cultures who are doing well have got to find ways to share that with these poor regions. So that's another one of those, both government and I think individual decisions. We all have to get behind these things and realize, oh, you want to stop this this issue of refugees and people migrating to different parts of the world and overwhelming parts of the world. You've got to address this issue of hunger in the world.
Oh, but Dan, how do we do that? How much time do we have to solve these really huge problems? And this is nothing new. I mean, you know, Silent Spring talked about how we were going to have food wars because we were overusing land. Resources were scarce already. They were going to be even worse as time went on if nobody started paying attention. And so we weren't producing enough food in so many areas, and people had to move to find food and water and so on. This isn't anything new, and we haven't done anything about it yet. And you know what I'm thinking? When we first started talking, we said we were going to try to make this a little more uplifting than a few of our previous episodes, now it sounds really sad.
Well, no, it's not totally sad because there have been lots of positive influences.
Will you be able to tell us what those are? Because we only have a few more minutes.
A few more minutes. No, you have to recognize that we, you know, the way our news cycles work is we tend to get the sensational stuff
that's true.
Often it's the negative, you know.
Tell me some unsensational,
good stuff. The UN has been doing a lot with this, you know, and they really are adding a lot of programs to some of these poorer parts of the world to help out both medically and food-wise and other things such as clean water systems.
That's true.
Which is huge, which is really where you have to start.
Yes, because I remember being told when I was in college that one of the greatest conflicts we're going to have is over water.
Yeah, we're already having it. Live out west.
Yeah,
water is privatized in the West. It's really weird.
How about you?
Weird for an Easterner to know, but they do that out West.
Okay, so we have to wrap up. What are we going to do?
Well, I think that's another piece where we have to start putting those demands on our leaders to be more active with that stuff. But you know, we have the United States, I think, has actually been pretty generous with a lot of our at least our financial and food support. We do quite a lot. We send a lot to places that need it. And I don't know that it's always, I guess it's kind of an efficiency question too. Like, is it really getting to the people who need it?
I always wonder.
Yeah, that's the piece I couldn't tell you about. But I would not say that we are turning our backs on these issues. I think that under the Obama-Biden presidency, huge things were done. And by the way, George W. Bush did a whole lot to reach out to some of these other countries and provide them with aid support, food, and all these things. And Obama continued a lot of that. And
And we can do that because we have the resources.
That's
we
right.
have people here in our
we
country
do.
Who need
we
food,
do.
And we need to think about that
that's
also.
Right. And so there's actually been plenty of positive things like that. They aren't hard to find. You just have to look, and it's all there. But you know, as a citizen, I guess everybody's got to start taking some responsibility to better inform themselves. What is going on? I mean, you know, we've participated in a hunger movement that started with John Lennon.
Yeah,
you
that's
know,
right.
For years,
yep.
we've been a part of that. And, you know, it's a small thing maybe, but we do our little bit.
Well, that's
and I'm proud of that because it's a grassroots sort of, you know, rock and roll kind of bunch that's supporting that. And they do some good stuff, you know. And so there's plenty of programs that are trying to do better. I think what really is not happening sometimes is the funding is never enough. And the funding maybe isn't being distributed in the most efficient ways. And so those are the things that maybe need to be looked at and corrected.
And you and I can't really do that every day, but we can
talk about
it so that people who are able to change those kinds of things can do it. But, you know, we started off by talking about, we wanted to look at the big picture, and we did talk about that a little bit, but we also came back to, like, grassroots and what you and I are doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we should end by saying that there has been, since I've lived in Western Massachusetts here in Franklin County, there are so many local efforts to do some of the
yes.
things that we have
yes.
just talked about. Like,
yes.
I buy your honey because
yeah. oh, yeah.
I know where it came from.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right there, and I can do that. So I'm not going to buy honey in a mm-hmm. store that came from one of our other wonderful states that makes great honey. I'm going to buy locally.
Mm-hmm.
We have many organizations that really help promote the idea of buying locally, of
yep.
not wasting food.
That's right.
There's a beautiful organization here in Greenfield. Oh, my gosh, I just forgot the name. Something Compost. And they will provide you with something, a container. You compost all your vegetable leftovers and products and so
yep.
on, and they come by and they pick it up and they turn it over to somebody who makes lots of compost for all of our gardens. We live in an area where we think about these things.
That's true.
And I think that by living here and buying locally and thinking about how we purchase and package things and how we try to keep using resources in a responsible way,
mm-hmm.
I think we're doing only what we can,
yep.
our part.
Yep. And you know, that's a good point. I mean, we've been a part of CISA, Community Involved in Sustainable Agriculture,
right.
pretty much since it started. And I was on the board of directors for a number of years. And we saw, basically, that was an idea kind of unique to this area to promote.
It was new.
Let's support farms and farmers.
Right.
But it was basically a network of businesses and individuals and
farms.
And financials and the farms. And that model has been pretty much exported all over the country now. So there's all these agricultural organizations that have a whole different, more, I think, a bigger umbrella kind of concept of it takes everybody to make this work.
Absolutely.
And it's catching on. So part of that is, you know, seed these ideas. You know,
seed the idea.
Seed the idea.
Exactly what somebody in an agricultural endeavor would do.
You know, and that's, you know, and beekeepers say cross-pollinate.
Oh, let's cross-pollinate.
Yeah, so anyway.
Well, I think that this is a good way that we could, like, say adios
yeah.
and
yeah.
just say, oh, I forgot already what you
so
said.
Pick,
seed what?
Well, I would say to anybody who's really interested in making a difference is look around and see what kind of groups are near you and pick one. Go to a couple of their
yeah.
gatherings or
pick
participate.
One. Oh.
Participate and get active.
That's perfect for an apple grower.
Yeah.
Pick one. Okay. Hey, Dan.
All right.
always, I learn so much when we have our conversations. I hope our listeners do too.
I do too.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
See you later.
See you later.
This concludes today's podcast. We're always looking for new ideas, so feel free to reach out to Judy Raper, Associate Dean of Community Engagement at Greenfield Community College at 413-775-1819 if you have an idea you'd love to share. Special thanks to the creators of Backyard Oasis, Denise Schwartz, Chad Fuller, Dennis Lee, and Christine Copeland. Have a great day.